I don't know if you know the Devil's Advocates, but they are kind of a big deal.
And we are back. Thank you for listening to the Devil's Advocates radio show. If you miss any of this fine program, please go online to domandcroot.com. You can listen to and download podcasts and interviews.
Dominic, our next fine guest is kind of a big deal in his own right. Former U.S. Attorney James Santel, friend of ours. Most importantly, we appreciate you coming around on a fine Friday afternoon, Jim.
Mike, Dom, good to be with you again on the day that we observe the one-year anniversary of President Trump's acquittal by the United States Senate, the first time he was impeached and tried, 1 year ago today.
Wow. Jim, let me start with the impeachment 2.0. First and foremost, would you expect any more evidence produced? And I understand Lindsey Graham said if you have even one witness, then you've opened Pandora's box. Well, open Pandora's box. Let's hear from all the witnesses necessary. But Jim, ultimately, the one witness I really wanted to hear from was Trump. And the Democrats requested his testimony. And, you know, he does have legal counsel now, at least this week. And apparently he has declined their kind request. Jim, why not lay a subpoena on his ass? He is the former president. Compel his testimony.
And
what say you, sir?
Exactly right, that Jamie Raskin asked for precisely that and asked for the voluntary appearance of the former president in a testimonial setting. And plainly, the former president's counsel, David Chain and Bruce Castor, referred to that as a publicity stunt and said that will not happen. I believe also indicated that they will not be reading any statement from the former president himself. You know, this is an interesting situation because, as always, we talk about this as a trial. If this were a criminal trial, of course, you could not compel the testimony of a criminal defendant to give up her or his Fifth Amendment rights. This is not that situation. The only concern I think that the attorneys for the former president could also have would be that the former president would also be under oath. James Madison and George Mason said this is an oath or affirmation. And plainly the things that you say, even in the well of the Senate, in a political proceeding, could be used against you. We also know under the Constitution, there's nothing to prevent a future prosecution for the same offenses. And so lots of different considerations here. Certainly would be interesting to see the president, former president, testify. Plainly not going to happen on advice of counsel, and plainly going to be relying, therefore, upon a broad category of other pieces of evidence that the House managers, including Jamie Raskin, will have to rally.
James, now,
if I may, Crudy, Jim, if Donald Trump does not come in to testify and is not compelled under subpoena, the assumption of the Senate is to be what? That he's guilty? That he cannot defend these words? Explain that legal quandary, if you would, please.
Sure, and this is exactly what Jamie Raskin is saying. And again, this is the kind of thing that in the civil context, we invoke all the time, that if there is a party, if there is a representative who declines to testify to provide information, the court can take the appropriate assumption. You can assume just the opposite of what their position would otherwise be. It's, you know, imputing to them the position that's contrary to what they would otherwise say. That's once again a civil concept in the context of regular litigation. In the criminal cases, plainly does not have an applicability because of the fact you can't be compelled to testify. But undeniably, in this situation, the interest in having the president testify would be considerable, thus Jamie Raskin's request. My thought is that they probably are going to be relying a huge amount, again, on the visual of the rally on the ellipse, the things the president said, the enticement, as they say, to insurrection. And, you know, interesting, some other possibilities here. One of the things that's got to be presented is the connection between what the former president said and what happened at the Capitol building. His attorneys are plainly going to maintain that, well, he was just exercising First Amendment rights, didn't intend any of that. So one of the connections is going to be, you know, what is that tie between the ellipse and the Capitol? Plainly, one of the things that could be identified would be the extent to which those people on the ellipse had plans for going to the Capitol before, did not have plans until the president told them to go down the street and raise hell, as he said. So lots of things can be drawn from the evidence that's there. I would anticipate lots of visuals here, certainly some testimony from individuals who may have been there as well to take in what the president said, but that connection is going to be all important between things said in the ellipse and what we all saw happened in the Capitol within an hour or so afterwards.
Jim, something not talked about a lot publicly, at least not to my viewing, is the propaganda video that was played as part of the pre-storming of the Capitol. And it was damn right Nazi-ish in its tone. And it immediately followed Rudy Giuliani and his calls for trial by combat. Can that video be introduced as an incitement in and of itself, Jim?
I think if you can make the connection to the president, and plainly you can, he plainly was the principal speaker there, and there was certainly some indication that the White House designed that and put that together. I think that's going to be a principal part of Jamie Raskin's and the House manager's presentations here. In the context of the impeachment article itself, it talks about a lot about what happened in the ellipse and says that the president there reiterated the false claim that we won this election, we won it by a landslide. If you don't fight like hell, you're going to have, you won't have a country anymore. That connection, once again, is all important. Things that Jamie Raskin may present in this trial that support that notion that the president did in fact intend for his words to have the impact that they had, including that video, Mike, could be very, very compelling. And my guess, again, is going to be showing the statements made, things that happened on the ellipse, and then showing what we've all seen, the impact of that on the assault on the Capitol. So I think any of that could be fair game. Interesting to see how it is that the presiding officer, Senator Patrick Leahy, will deal with some of that and the evidentiary considerations related to it. But assuming he gives the managers free rein to present what they need to do to establish that intent and that connection, it certainly would be relevant, I think, in most people's assessment.
Jim, I want to talk about the former president, 45's legal defense, or at least his impeachment defense. My understanding, Republicans would like him to fight the process. It's unconstitutional, but my understanding is his legal team has inserted a second defense, air quotes. I want to ask you about it. The big lie. He wants to introduce it as part of his legal defense. More Devil's Advocates. We got a fine guest. He is James Santel, former U.S. attorney. Come right back.
Let's have trial by combat.
No, I don't take responsibility at all.
The Devil's Advocates. They refuse to do math on the radio.
Welcome back to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. This show moving right along with a fine guest. His name, James Santel. He's a former U.S. attorney. He's a friend of ours. Jim, appreciate you joining us this Friday. Let's talk about that legal defense for the former president, the impeachment defense. Now, the clear case to be made is that it's unconstitutional in some way, shape, or form. And I think they'd be wrong, but at least the process argument would give enough cover to like 45 Republicans. And that's all they really want at this point. They just want to put this behind them quickly. But Jim, the fact that the president seems to make the case that it's election fraud. Did I get that part wrong, or is that included in the brief that he submitted to the Senate?
Sure, it certainly seems to be a part of the president's continuing advocacy, of course, even behind the scenes, that he wants to revisit that entire issue. As to your first point, you've also got it exactly right, which is the argument about whether or not this is a constitutional proceeding. While I think most people would say, yes, the Senate can, in fact, proceed with an impeachment trial, even if the identity of the person who is the focus of the trial has already left the office, you don't have to remove them. There is that second remedy that it's related to prohibiting that person from ever serving in that capacity again. So I think most people say that there is a jurisdictional basis for it. But to your good point, Mike, reasonable people can differ on that. And so that's one of those things that it would provide some cover if you look at that and say, gee, I really believe that we're improperly here. Plainly, we have seen that at least 45 senators already believe in that theory, and maybe that it is the thing that they look to justify their vote on this. The more important issue, however, is when we get to the substance, what is the defense going to be all about? And plainly, the president's current advisors have been wrestling with this, and you can see it in their brief, their answers submitted, and their writings. My understanding is that Shane and the former DA from Pennsylvania are trying their as best they can to indicate that, well, what we're really talking about here is the president was exercising his First Amendment right to articulate that view, even if it was wrong, and they did not have the intent to entice. That, again, is the kind of thing that you reach to when you don't have a whole lot more to advance, but at least it's got some colorable validity, only because it's not embracing, as you said before the break, the big lie that in fact there was in fact election fraud. And I would say that if you go down that road in context of criminal prosecution, civil litigation, when someone makes a statement, tells that kind of big lie, it really does discredit the legitimate arguments it could otherwise make. And so I think it's fraught with danger if they do decide to adopt what former President Trump may be encouraging them to adopt, which is let's relitigate whether or not indeed there was election fraud. It's a big mistake. And even if the politics isn't there in the Senate right now, it certainly is not going to get you more votes already.
Jim, this is perhaps the most well-documented insurrection in history. How much of that video or snippets of videos do you think we'll see as part of the impeachment trial? And above and beyond that, maybe Trump won't testify, but how many witnesses, or do you think there will be witnesses offered at the Senate trial?
Sure. I think, as you indicated, this is one of those trials, whether you're in a federal district court or a state civil court or the Senate, where visuals are going to be all important. And I think you do the juxtaposition. If you're Jamie Raskin and others, you do begin at the ellipse. And you begin with the comments made by the president and focus on that. And this business about taking back the country, you won't have a country anymore, fight like hell, all those kinds of things, inviting them to walk down the street, I'll be with you. You spend a lot of time doing those visuals and setting up the predicate for this. And then you do the bookend, which is, again, choose your horrific looking video about what happened at the Capitol. Interestingly, to again, investigatively, I don't know if they've got access to this, but to explore what was the president himself doing. We've got all these reports about him being back at the White House watching TV. Well, if he didn't have the intent that would happen, any rational chief executive would be reaching out and saying, stop that. Let's send the National Guard there. Let's support them with the DC police. That is not what I intended. If you could somehow capture a witness who would say that, in fact, the president was watching this with either sort of a blank stare or even some delight, that would certainly suggest that he intended this very thing to happen. Whether or not Jamie Raskin has the capacity to find that person or find that information, present that, I would think that's very compelling. What you did to try to stop it, if in fact you did not intend to start it in the first place, I think that's a very compelling argument.
Folks, you're listening to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Jim Santel, former U.S. attorney, friend of ours, joining us via the Zoom. Jim, thank you for doing so. The First Amendment fight here, the defense that they may come in with. I mean, you don't have a First Amendment right to yell fire in a theater, right? I mean, there are limitations to the First Amendment, and this isn't even technically on meeting a criminal standard. This is just whether or not he violated his oath of office, right?
Absolutely. And those are two great points. Let's start with the second one, which is, once again, we don't have to prove something here beyond a reasonable doubt. We don't have to prove things by compelling evidence or preponderance of the evidence. Those are all civil and criminal standards. This is, frankly, as Gerald Ford once said about impeachment articles, it is what you think. It is whatever members of the Congress think is in violation of your oath. And so each individual member will have to bring to his or her assessment exactly what their own internal meter, their own compass tells them it's all about. And so you're absolutely right that on those fundamental standards really are not applicable here inside this political process. As to the First Amendment, again, absolutely right. The expression of fire in a crowded theater is often used. There are many other situations like that. Remember that this is the allegation here is, you know, incitement to insurrection. It's prompting people to do something that they would not otherwise do. And boy, when you look at the president's statements, again, not only on the cold piece of paper, I can read them to you. They sound fairly, frankly, wildly egregious and wildly inciting. But when you play it visually and you even show the crowd and see the impact that your statement has, again, once again, you point down Pennsylvania Avenue and you say, I'm going to be there with you. That is precisely the kind of thing that incitement is all about. It plainly is the sort of thing that is described at great length in the text of the article of impeachment that precedes the final allegations that the president had violated his oath of office. All of that very, very compelling in terms of establishing that the president meant to do exactly what happened. Now, plainly, there would be pushback from the defense on that based upon the fact that, hey, he was just saying what he felt strongly about. You can't punish him for that. But again, we also apply a reasonableness standard, right? We always say, bring your common sense, bring your sense of human behavior to the whatever assessment you make. That's true of any civil or criminal trial, should be here as well. I suspect you hear Jamie Raskin make that argument too. What is the rational implication of what you're saying? What is the normal consequence? What do rational people think of when they hear these things? How would you react to it?
And Jamie Raskin, I guess to get back to our point on the last segment, that if Donald Trump does not come in and testify, that they will assume this is an adverse inference, right? That they will assume that what his lawyers are saying are and his defense is not true if he does not come and testify. So that part set aside, what about other witnesses that may, in some regards, like Donald Trump, be subject in the future to criminal investigation? What happens if you bring in one of these people who are charged? Can they testify without, you know, further endangering themselves to further prosecution?
Right. You raise your right hand and you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And that applies whether you're in a deposition, a civil deposition, or you're in front of a grand jury, or in front of the United States senators gathered together as a jury to determine what happened here. And so it is recorded. It is plainly a court, not in the traditional sense, but it's a statement under oath. And again, absent some grant of immunity, which I don't think the Justice Department is going to grant to anybody for their testimony here, what you say will carry with you. And again, as we know from the Constitution, but generally beyond that is under general principles, if I make a statement under oath, it can be used against me unless there is some other privilege that's not there. So there is some great consequence to this. You know, the other aspect of your question that comes to mind is, let us suppose you find a witness who is there at the Ellipse, who can come in and testify maybe in the opposite direction and say, you know, I was there. I was there because I wanted to hear what my president had to say. I was enticed. I was incited, if you will, by his very words. And I wasn't planning to do it until he told me to. That's a compelling witness in support of the impeachment article, right?
Jim, what about some of the allegedly involved Congress people like Mo Brooks from Alabama or Biggs or Gozar from Arizona, is it possible that we're going to see testimony of their conspiracies with the administration or perhaps with Ali Alexander and other supporters of Save the Steal? Could this be a impeachment trial of Trump that also implicates some of the Congress people?
Sure. And I think that the implication would be sort of derivative, so to speak, to string cite long multi-syllable words there. It's very well possible that if there is testimony about who is doing what kind of sense you had from the president's comments, that others, you can make reference to other people and other events, that sort of thing. My sense is, again, being a bit of an evidentiary purist in these kinds of things, is that it would be wise for the managers and wise for the presiding judicial officer, Senator Leahy, to narrowly focus on what the former president did and said and intended to do. And if you do, in fact, get involved in these other stories, it tends to dilute your principal focus, which is whether or not this particular person should be convicted of this particular offense conduct under the Constitution, violating his oath, and should therefore be prevented from ever holding office again. You get into some of those stories, they're interesting. They might be especially concerning for those peripheral people, those collateral folks who also may have had some involvement in this. But I also think it runs the risk of not focusing laser-like on exactly what happened here. Doesn't mean to say that those other people do not have some potential criminal exposure outside of this. And again, if people say things about their involvement under oath, those things could be used in those other proceedings. But here, I think the presiding officer and the managers would be wise to narrowly focus this on those things that directly support the multi-page and multi-paragraph impeachment article.
But Jim, you know, one of my concerns here is that we're 30 days away from the insurrection. We still have ongoing criminal investigations, right? And as a side, I want to get your take on how well they are doing in relating to the American people, what the hell is happening. But that aside, are you concerned that there's other information, other facts that are still being dug up that would ultimately show to a much greater degree, perhaps the coordination between Trump and some of his subordinates? Investigative journalist Seth Abramson is saying the night before there was a big meeting at the Trump International Hotel with Trump and some of the family and some of the funders and a big crew. He's calling it a war room. Now, this is on his reporting. I haven't seen it specifically on major newspapers, but assuming these kinds of things have happened, and with cell phone records and the tech, we can understand that some of these may have been occurring should the criminal investigation be proceeding in that manner. But if we're going forward so quickly on this, you know, some of these things that may end up coming out would be helpful to their case, Jim.
Absolutely. Not only not a disagreement on that, but a strong endorsement of that. That is the downside of moving this quickly again, and I use those words sort of advisedly, because on the one hand, of course, you're still using the immediacy of what happened. You've got members of the Congress, obviously as late as yesterday, still recounting the horror of being there in that day and the things that happened to them. But to your point, the technology can show us through cell phone pings and all sorts of meetings, as you indicated, that may have happened that we are only slowly learning about in the course of this investigation, that could be very, very persuasive if this trial were to happen in 6 months from now. And that's always the case with white collar cases, violent crime cases. When you begin to peel the onion back, if you will, you get more and more. And the more you find out, it both affirms, sometimes it refutes your principal theses about what happened, but it also always informs the intelligence by which you present something. So I think that is a concern. And again, my guess is that Jamie Raskin and folks are not scrambling, but doing everything they can to probably put this together right now.
James Hintel, sit right there, man. I got questions about the defamation suits and the billions of dollars.
The president in no way, form or fashion, has ever promoted or encouraged violence.
So if you see somebody getting ready to throw a tomato, knock the crap out of them, would you?
I would have gotten away with it too if it wasn't for those meddling devil's advocates.
And we are back. Thank you for listening to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. If you want to relive or recheck in on any of the fine programming here on the Devil's Advocates Show, go to domandcrute.com. You can listen to and download podcasts and interviews.
Dominic, we've asked our fine guest to stick around for one more segment. He is James Hintel, former U.S. attorney. He's our legal eagle. And I got to ask you, moving on from the impeachment to the defamation suits, I think we're up to like $4 billion being sought by the plaintiffs in two separate suits. Let's talk about this. Rudy Giuliani, Sidney Powell, the legal teams for the former president. Jim, how much liability do you think they actually face? I mean, they got E&O insurance, right?
These again are fascinating lawsuits because, you know, at base, they're alleging a damage to the commercial operations of Dominion. At the head of them, there are other lawsuits out there plainly, but Dominion saying that because of the things that Giuliani and Sidney Powell and others said publicly, their value as a company has been diminished. And my guess is that they may be able to come forward with some economic support for that notion. Plainly, once again, speaking about evidence, you put out there the specific things that the lawyers for the now former president has said about them. And you've got a pretty good lawsuit there. There's no doubt that the litigating that they're doing up to this point, both in the public domain, and I think one of the representatives said, we're going to take this out of the public domain, put it into court. I think it's very well placed. And beyond that, it sends this important, we've always talked about deterrence on our my conversations with you, and this notion that you can get out there and say anything about anybody, anytime, is simply not true. That's not what the First Amendment says. And there are limits to that. And yes, we give you an awful lot of a free space under New York Times versus Sullivan in the political realm, but there also is a responsibility, as we talked in the prior segment, about what you say and what you do. And this is an effort by Dominion and probably others to say, you know what? We're not going to let you get away with it. And to the extent that it deters not only those particular lawyers, but also others out there who might do the same thing down the road, good for them. And we'll look forward to seeing what the courts do in the resolution of these billion-dollar lawsuits. Absolutely.
Well, it's not just Trump's legal team or former legal team. It also is Fox News and a handful of the Fox News hosts, including Maria Bartiromo and Lou Dobbs and Jeannie Pirro, Judge Jeannie, who is a Saturday Night product. How did they skip Tucker and Sean Hannity is what I want to know. But how do you think this particular threesome of hosts was selected, Jim? I mean, there was lots of culpability going around, lots of defamation and misstatements and false statements being made by various Fox News hosts. Jim, A, do you worry at all that this targeting of a major media corporation is problematic? And B, why didn't Tucker and Hannity get served?
Right. And so, sure, we always have those concerns, right? We don't want to chill our media because, again, even though the First Amendment does have some limitations on it, it is, as I said before, a pretty wide berth. You want to make certain that there will be public discourse out there. And yes, indeed, when it comes to political things, there's an awful lot you can say with impunity or close to that. On the other hand, as we have talked before in other settings, the interesting things about these lawsuits, including those against the anchors and the others there, would be to take civil discovery, right? And when you file a civil lawsuit, you get this opportunity to sit down and you subpoena, you're compelled to, by virtue of the court's process, to sit down and ask and answer questions. And you can answer questions about, you know, who told you what? What was the source of this information? Did your producer encourage you to make this up out of whole cloth? Where did that come from? What was your purpose in doing it? You can ask those questions. And yes, you may get pushback from counsel for Fox and others, but it certainly does give you an opportunity to explore this in a way that we have not previously seen, certainly in the public domain, and not up to now, really, in the courts either. So I look forward to that as well as a way of sort of answering this larger question about where does public responsibility and media responsibility come for saying things that are truly made up out of whole cloth.
Jim, you've often talked about talking indictments here on the show. This obviously a civil action, but I loved at least how they began to express the civil action. The first line of the lawsuit: the world is round. And then they went through other, let's call them facts. You know, Joe Biden won the election, and effectively the defendants know that these are facts, and they said things to the contrary despite. Jim, what was your impression? How'd you like the brief?
Just that. Again, I was stricken by the same sort of thing. You know, people often think that, gosh, lawyers have got to use multisyllabic words to convey anything. And the answer is, yes, sometimes there are concepts that judges and lawyers and even parties need to invoke. But the law should also reflect the real world, right? And to begin with that and to infuse in your brief, again, this common sense notion about what facts are, what the truth is. And it, in addition to conveying, as it must, a cause of action, jurisdiction, personal and substantive, all those kinds of lawyer things we've talked about before, it's also a public document. And you want people to be able to digest it and say, yes, this is what it's all about. The sun does not, in fact, rise in the west. The world is not, in fact, flat, and you won't fall off of it if you go too far west. Those kinds of, and by doing that, you not only attract the attention of the public, but you let the judge, the presiding officer, and maybe one day a jury, if you get a jury, to be able to understand a case that in the end should be stripped of its legal complexity, if you will, and reduced to exactly what you just said, Mike, which is, you know, what's right to say? And what is too far? What is too far? And obviously the focus of this complaint and all the complaints is this is way too far. You're not even close to something that reasonable people can disagree about. You're way beyond the pale. And that's what the message of that kind of language is all about. So I applaud it.
James Santel, former U.S. attorney, 2 more minutes left in this fine segment, my friend. Okay, so let's assume the plaintiffs are successful in a $2.7 billion lawsuit against Fox News and hosts and people like Rudy Giuliani. I mean, Rudy's out there hawking gold coins and cigars, Jim. I'm assuming he doesn't have his share of the $2.7 billion that he would owe if found liable.
Lean his ass. Lean
him. What happens? You can't get blood from a stone, Jim. Rather owe it to you forever than never pay you. What happens if Giuliani doesn't have the $2.7 billion?
Right. Well, you get a judgment, first of all, and it stays with you, and it does attach to any property that you do have. If you try to sell it, if you try to do things, you know, this is a matter of collection then, right? In the literal sense of the word, do you garnish wages, those kinds of things? And, you know, with respect to these larger entities that do, in fact, have a deep pocket, there again, you can sit down as a part of your collection effort and say, you know, what is your bottom line? How much do you make? And what kinds of judgments can you, what dollar amounts can you enforce in the courts to ensure that you get paid? There are ways of enforcing these judgments, especially if maybe unlike the Rudy Giuliani's, who may not be that wealthy today, do have some large amounts of money, and courts can in fact go back in with supplemental proceedings is what it's called, and you can go in and enforce that judgment and get and compel them to pay you through all sorts of enforcement mechanisms, including seizing monies and doing other things like that civilly to ensure that you're paid and that the judgment is not just an empty $100,000 judgment, $1 million or multi-billion-dollar judgment. That can happen, and it can bring companies down, as we well know.
Rudy will pay you $20 a week for the rest of his life. Thank you, James Santel. Thank you all, the AM 950 listeners. Stick around for Matt McNeil, the rest of you. More Devil's Advocates. It's the 4 o'clock happy hour.
Thank you, Jim.
Take care, John. Take care.
I always want to tell the truth. When I can, I tell the truth.
Have to beat that off. They don't stop.
Stand back and stand by.
It is what it is.
No, I don't take responsibility at all.